This is an ABC podcast.
The COVID-19 pandemic has played havoc with the supply chains of many products, everything from personal protective equipment to toilet paper. But what has the closing of our borders meant for heroin supplies? Hi, Damien Carrick here. This is the Law Report. That story shortly. First, to a decision of the Supreme Court of Victoria. Last Friday, Judge Ghanane refused to release prisoner Mark Rosen. His lawyer, Karen Fletcher, from the Fitzroy Legal Service, had argued that Rosen is, quote, a sitting duck. He's particularly vulnerable if he contracts COVID-19 whilst in prison.
He is a prisoner at the Port Phillip Prison, which is a private prison operated by G4S here in Melbourne. He is in his early 50s. He has a cardiac condition, asthma. He's suffered pneumonia associated with a cardiac operation fairly recently. He has difficulties controlling blood pressure. And as such, being male and having these health conditions, he's at risk if he did contract COVID-19 of serious injury or death.
And to give people some background, he was sentenced to 5 years jail, I think, in December 2018 for defrauding a mentally ill friend of 40 years. He took something like $300,000 out in loans and credit card debt in his dying friend's name. What was the argument that you put before the court that he should be released from jail?
Mr. Rowson made a application under the Corrections Act here for administrative leave on health grounds. When it wasn't responded to or even acknowledged by Corrections, he took the matter to court. Last week, we applied for an interlocutory injunction as his legal representatives that he be released while a substantive case in tort and in judicial review was prepared, which probably happened in June or July. We made an interlocutory application that he should be released immediately because of the serious risk to his health.
Last week, you kind of failed in getting him out of jail pending the hearing of that case in June. Now, tell me, what are the prison conditions that Mark Rosen is being housed in? I believe he's housed in something called the Gorgon Unit at Port Phillip Prison. Tell me about that.
So the Gorgon Unit has 50 cells. There are 70 men in there at the moment. A number of the cells are doubled up in that they're designed for single accommodation, but they have bunks in them. Our client, Mr. Rosen, has a single cell.
It's about 2.6 metres by 3 metres, right?
That's correct. He drew a diagram of his cell for the court to show just how close his head was to the toilet. The issue is probably not only just the cell, but the common area. Lots of touch points that people are touching all the time. People coming in from work. They have a commercial laundry at Port Phillip Prison. It's where a lot of the men in Mr. Rosen's unit work, dealing with laundry that comes with blood and blood products, feces, etc. There are contractors and cleaners and prison officers coming in and out all of the time. Mr. Rosen's evidence to the court was that there's not good hygiene in there, not good cleaning. They got one piece of soap, which was 40 grams at the beginning of the epidemic, and after that they have to buy their own soap for about 75 cents a bar when some of them have no money, and that cleaning products and cleaning equipment is just not easily accessible. So he described some of the conditions in the toilets and other commonly used parts of the prison extremely dirty and was very concerned about the lack of hygiene in the unit.
But on the other hand, the lawyer for the State of Victoria told the court last week that the arguments for releasing your client were, quote, exceptionally weak because there have been no prisoners diagnosed with COVID-19 in Victoria or indeed, I think, elsewhere in Australia yet.
There have been prison officers diagnosed in other places, but luckily there hasn't been an outbreak in a prison. We were very surprised that the state had such a strong opinion that there was such a tiny risk in prisons because, in fact, the risk of a second spike or a third spike in Australia is unknown. There is still no vaccine for this virus. All of us in the community are still being urged to maintain extraordinary measures for social distancing. And the court itself, the judge noted, meeting by teleconference because we weren't able to actually meet in the court. So whilst Australia is in a good position in relation to the virus, the risk hasn't gone away. We're not out of the woods yet, I think was the phrase that the judge used. Whilst the risk of the virus getting into the prison now is probably small. The point we were making was that the risk to our client, if it does, is very serious, including a risk of death.
Because of his age and his comorbidities, right?
That's right. And that's the issue that's really of importance more generally, I think, that there are lots of people in prisons and detention centres, and particularly youth detention, who have very poor health. And so that's what makes this case, I think, quite important at this time.
But the judge pointed out that prisons are taking, you know, really big steps. New prisoners are quarantined for 14 days before they're let out into the kind of group areas. And there are, I believe, even as of last week, temperature checks for both staff and prisoners.
The evidence about the temperature checks is very interesting because, in fact, temperature checks only started at Port Phillip during the course of the trial last week. And we are hopeful that as a result of this case, there will be more measures of that type. But we are concerned that Australian authorities, prison authorities, and the Victorian government are moving more towards these kind of shutdown, banning of visits, quarantining of prisoners, segregation and isolation of prisoners as measures in COVID-19, rather than addressing what all public health experts say is the most important public health measure that you can take for prisoners and detainees, which is to reduce the density of the population in those places.
I mean, on the flip side, many people listening to this will be saying, look, why do we want to let prisoners who've been convicted of very serious crimes out back onto the streets?
Well, yes, but most prisoners who are in prisons aren't there for very serious crimes. I mean, our client was serving, as you say, quite a long sentence, just over 5 years, but for a non-violent offence.
A pretty ugly crime, though, a pretty ugly crime.
Yes, but the vast majority of prisoners in Australian prisons are there for a very short period of time, and, you know, less than 6 months. Many of them are actually there at the moment having been convicted of nothing because they're on remand awaiting their trial. And during COVID-19, they could be there for a very long time waiting for their trial because during the pandemic, the courts have had to, you know, reduce the number of cases that they're dealing with. So it might take a while for their day in court to come up. So I think it's distorting of the discussion to say that we're talking about people who've committed very serious crimes. Some of them are there for technical breaches of parole, technical breaches of community corrections orders. And what we're saying is that those are the people that should be moved out, and the people who have serious health problems and don't pose a risk to the safety of the community.
Karen Fletcher, lawyer with the Fitzroy Legal Service. I'm Damien Carrick. This is the Law Report on Radio National and, of course, available anytime, anywhere, wherever you get your podcasts. And if you do like the program, please do give us a rating and a review. It really helps others find us. Now to the impact of COVID-19 border closures on the supply of imported drugs such as heroin. Associate Professor Suzanne Nielsen from the Centre of Addiction Research at Monash University says at any one time there are about 100,000 injecting drug users in Australia.
In addition to that, there's around an estimated 50,000 people who are currently in treatment for opioid dependence. Some of those may be people who inject drugs as well. And separate from that, we've had estimates that there are around maybe 150,000 people who might be dependent on pharmaceutical or prescription opioids, so medicines for pain. So those are, you know, perhaps a small amount of overlap between those populations, but three, you know, potentially different groups that might be affected in different ways currently with COVID.
Well, let's talk about how the COVID-19 pandemic is affecting the supply of drugs, imported drugs especially. What do we know about what's going on the street?
In terms of illicit opioids in Australia, most of those would come from overseas. And so we know that that's been quite disrupted. So we're not having the same level of flights coming in and out. And we're also not having the same level of movement around the country. We expect those things to be affected, although it's a little bit too early to get any really reliable data on how those things have been affected. We are hearing anecdotal reports that there's been some fluctuations in purity and price. So in some cases, it's thought that perhaps heroin in some areas is not as strong as it maybe historically has been over the last few years, or is maybe a little bit more expensive. But even that, speaking to sort of experts and people on the ground across the country, seems to be varying somewhat around Australia.
So how are drug users responding to this interruption in supply? Do changes in supply pose dangers? Sione Crawford is the executive officer with Harm Reduction Victoria, an NGO that works with the drug-using community.
So let's just use some really normal terms. So there's a point is a tenth of a gram. So a point might go for $50 normally. That point's quality might have dropped, you know, by 20 or 30%. And so a person might start using, you know, 1.5 points or more. That may go for a week or two. If the quality rises back up again and those people can, the person continues to use that amount, that's where the overdose problems can occur.
And are you hearing that there has been an increase in overdoses?
So it's very hard to have at the moment to have objective information and data about overdose. Usually the data lags behind. So what I'm going to talk about is anecdotal evidence, and so basically stories that we hear from our peer community. And it's certainly the case that it appears that overdoses are continuing. And one of the things we know that can protect against overdose is actually not using alone. And during COVID-19, of course, people are being asked to self-isolate. And if people don't have a family or a partner or friends in their home or in the place that they are sleeping or living, then they are at just that much higher risk of overdose. And I've certainly heard of overdoses within the community of people that I know just recently.
Sione Crawford, we're talking about self-isolating. You know, there are these laws that we have around social distancing. Have drug users found themselves fined for breaching social distancing rules, and perhaps more so than the wider population?
I think it's without doubt we can say that we've had reports that people who use drugs have been fined for breaching the COVID-19 regulations, especially towards the start of the lockdown. There is actually a wide range of circumstances, and one of the ways that people might be stopped is while they're driving. What we have heard is that often what follows along from that, if you don't have a legitimate excuse for being out, or you can't think quickly enough to tell the police officer why you're out and about, searches have certainly been known to happen, and people have been fined both for COVID-19 breaches and drug possession. But also people who are highly marginalised, who don't potentially have an opportunity to self-isolate by going to a home, which they may not have. We've certainly heard that people in those circumstances, with their windscreen washing or with their just literally on the street, we've definitely heard of fines being levied against those people. So people who may well already have sort of multiple fines already have been policed.
Are these happening in areas which are widely understood to be areas where people go to buy drugs?
Yes, absolutely. I think that there are pretty well known areas around Melbourne at the moment where there is a known street drug market, and those places include Footscray, they include Richmond, for instance, as well.
Richmond is also home to the city's safe injecting room. Are you also seeing an increased police presence around that facility?
We partner with the injecting room, but we do not work at the injecting room as an organisation at the moment. And so what we see is certainly from the outside. Our workers and our community who live in that area have absolutely seen what appears to them anyway to be an increased level of policing around that area. And we were particularly disappointed by this because we felt that potentially the COVID-19 situation might have been an opportunity to actually exercise more discretion in terms of not chasing people down for drug possession, but instead still focusing on dealing. And our concern certainly is that the more police that are in the area of Richmond, the less likely it is that people are going to want to use that injecting room.
Well, let's talk about how the COVID-19 pandemic and the need, the real need for safe physical distancing has impacted on the provision of services. And of course, there are many services, but let's start with the safe injecting rooms. So in Melbourne and elsewhere, how have they responded to the need for safe social distancing?
Look, MSIR is always really busy and has been doing a great job in terms of its core function, which is to stop people from dying. They, along with most drug treatment facilities, have had to introduce social distancing. It's absolutely the right thing to do. And what it shows, though, is just how important those services are, because as their capacity decreases slightly due to social distancing, so the demand continues for those services. We certainly hear of circumstances where people feel like, as much as they want to use the injecting room, they feel that the combination of increased policing along with the fact that there are fewer available booths at any one time means that people are more likely to be actually injecting on the street and in places where they perhaps would rather not.
Now, a lot of opioid drug users seek treatment, methadone treatment, and normally that involves attending a pharmacist daily, as I understand it, where they're sort of handed the small plastic cup which they must ingest there and then. But have processes been changed in light of the COVID pandemic?
That's right, absolutely. The Department of Health and Human Services, along with the AOD sector and organisations like Harm Reduction Victoria's program called PAMS, were involved in changing some of the guidance around the way that the pharmacotherapy program is delivered during the time of the COVID pandemic. And that, absolutely, as you said, has resulted in some guidance being handed down that allows prescribers and pharmacists, for that matter, to apply their judgment and to balance the risks against the rewards for offering more takeaway doses to people who are on the pharmacotherapy program. And that could be a methadone dose, but it also could be a product called buprenorphine naloxone. The idea behind that is that by offering longer prescriptions, so usually a person would get a prescription for around about a month's worth of this medication, but being able to offer 2 or 3 month long prescriptions to stable clients and being able to offer further takeaway doses to people up to around 6 a week, I think, for people who are stable and for whom the prescriber feels there is very low risk.
So this is quite a profound change to the way that methadone and other medications have been distributed to patients, right?
It's certainly a profound change in the sense that it's extending to people who previously may not have been able to get the number of takeaways that they wanted or needed to, say, get back to work, for instance. And that's a really important consideration for people who are on that program. But also there's another change that was brought in that is a completely new thing that hasn't been in place in Victoria before, to my knowledge anyway, and that's an innovation called third-party pickups. And really what that means is that if a person who's on the pharmacotherapy program became ill with COVID-19 or showed symptoms and they were not able to get a test, there was the opportunity for a third party, like a trusted friend, someone who has to fill in a form and do a little bit of identification work, that third party would be able to pick up doses for the person who was affected by COVID-19 in some way and not able to leave the house. And in the extreme circumstances, that could be through a registered courier. It's very, very rare occurrence, but it's important to note that this sort of thing is undertaken for other types of medication as well. So in a sense, it's bringing it in line with that and also keeping the community just that much safer.
Sione Crawford, Executive Officer with Harm Reduction Victoria, who tells me that some other parts of Australia have also adopted similar changes to their methadone programs. And just last week, national guidelines were released. But this isn't the only major change in the regulation of treatment of drug-dependent people. Associate Professor Suzanne Nielsen says by sheer chance, another major reform has just come online in Victoria. Real-time prescription monitoring gives doctors and pharmacists accurate, up-to-date information about a patient's medication history of high-risk pharmaceutical drugs.
As of the 1st of April, it's legislated that health professionals are now required to be checking that before prescribing and dispensing a whole range of sort of high-risk medicines in the community. So that includes opioids, so prescription pain medicines, and also a few other medicines, sleeping pills and other medicines that might be subject to non-medical use or be high risk.
And this is to stop people who might be drug dependent, pharmaceutical drug dependent, from, say, doctor shopping or, you know, in the very odd case, finding a doctor who's happy to look away and continually prescribe.
Yeah, look, I think that it's something that health professionals have been calling for many years, is to have more information when they're prescribing or supplying medicines so that that can be safer. And it is intended as a, you know, a clinical tool. So the information that you receive on the prescription monitoring, it would give you some alerts to let you know if somebody meets criteria for sort of some high-risk categories, and that can be high doses of opioids or combinations of opioids and other high-risk medicines.
And how does this real-time prescription monitoring dovetail in with the very unexpected and sudden COVID-19 pandemic?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm pretty sure the people who've been working on this prescription monitoring for many, many years had never envisaged that the mandatory implementation date would fall in the midst of this global pandemic. And so I guess what's happened is, ideally, if somebody is identified as perhaps being having a pattern of substance use that's risky and maybe that shouldn't continue, that what would happen is that they would be referred, you know, perhaps to treatment. But getting them other kinds of care right now might be a little bit more complicated.
And indeed, as well as the sort of, you know, the telemedicine interactions with healthcare professionals, for real problem drug users, they want inpatient drug rehab. And of course, those facilities have to comply with safe social distancing. So their physical capacities or the numbers of people that they can help are being reduced, right?
Exactly, yes. So we know that our treatment spots are already insufficient. So it is a high pressure time for those services.
Associate Professor Suzanne Nielsen. Another much praised initiative in response to the COVID-19 crisis has been the provision of emergency accommodation in hotels for those without homes. Around the country, thousands of homeless people with complex needs are now enjoying safe, warm beds. Sione Crawford welcomes this initiative, but he says it isn't straightforward, especially for drug users.
Sure, there are absolutely unintended consequences, many innovations that we come up with. And while it's absolutely laudable to try to house as many people as possible, one of the issues that we've certainly seen is that people are often expected to pay up to 50% of their benefits for the accommodation. And that's a huge proportion for people who are already struggling. And if people do happen to have an illicit drug dependence as well, and previously were needing to spend most of their income on drugs, making the choice between being housed versus spending money to stop being sick is a wicked dilemma for many, many people. And certainly in my lived experience of drug dependence, I think that I would possibly well have chosen to go without the hotel and be able to spend the money day to day, which may seem counterintuitive to a lot of people out there. But when you're used to not having a roof over your head, when you haven't seen the news as often as others, when you don't know quite the impact that COVID-19 might well have on you, making that choice can seem very logical at the time. The other thing that we sort of worry about as well is isolation. We talked a little bit before about people being isolated at home and overdosing, but we do know that people are being put into hotels, which is a very positive thing often for them. But generally speaking, that will be by themselves. They may well be with people that either don't know or people they don't get along with. And it can cause sort of some social issues as well. But on top of that, hotel workers are not, generally speaking, as far as I know, community and social workers. And so it's putting quite a burden on them to have to manage a cohort of folks who have got multiple issues. And while there is certainly some work going on in terms of supporting people in those hotels, and we've got great homeless services in Victoria, there are sort of unintended consequences with any of these approaches.
John, not his real name, shares those concerns. He's an allied health peer worker at a city homeless service in Melbourne.
We've become aware of a stabbing, an overdose, a couple of assaults. And a couple of days ago, at the front of one of the hotels, there was a dozen police officers, you know, and so it's created a really, what would you call it, sort of explosive sort of situation. What was really dangerous is that the staff are not equipped. They're not equipped with the resources or the training to deal with people that are in crisis. There was no naloxone on site.
Naloxone is a drug you administer to people who are having an overdose, is that right?
Yeah, it stops the heroin from acting on your central nervous system and it basically brings them back to life. One of my colleagues, whose job it is to coordinate with the social workers that are there. So there's three social workers there from about 10 o'clock to 4, 4:30. And look, I'm not laying blame. They're not equipped to deal with the situation either. And so they're overwhelmed by the situation.
Presumably, people are having a range of experiences. So some people might find this a fantastic option, but other people, it's not serving their needs. Is that what you're seeing, a spectrum of responses?
Definitely.
Do you know, are there homeless people who are exiting this arrangement? Are there people who are actually leaving the hotels?
Yeah, you look, there's a number of people that I've spoken to that are frustrated with the situation and have been there for a week or two and have just left.
Some of these people are drug users. How's that impact on these living arrangements?
It puts the drug using community right in the crosshairs of the police. And because there's no one out on the street, the drug using street-based community stick out. Like, I don't work far from one of the hotels, and it was quite obvious what was going on. It made what was already a quite difficult situation, that going to score on the street, even more dangerous, I suppose, and put you at risk of being fined or arrested and charged. You know, 100 people were put into one motel. When they've been put into one location without the resources, support and the planning to do it right, it's a recipe for disaster.
But you'd acknowledge it's also very well intentioned.
Yes, I'm not trying to lay blame, Damien.
It's lovely to house people, but there are multiple other issues that we need to manage alongside them. And I think that an emergency response to COVID has been fantastic in Victoria by and large. So what we need to think about really now are the longer term responses and approaches, because I think that a lot of the situation that we're in now will probably need to continue for a number of months, and it's now time to really think about how we bed in some of these innovations and make them work for people a little bit better.
Sione Crawford from Harm Reduction Victoria pointing out, like John, a peer worker from a homeless service before him, that while it's great to provide safe shelter during this pandemic, governments need to look further to the future to permanently address some of the issues around homelessness and drug addiction. That's the Law Report. I'm Damien Carrick. Big thanks to producer Anita Barrow and to sound engineer this week, Richard Gervin. And if you can't wait until next week's program for more law, you should check out a new series here on Radio National. It's called Section 71. It brings you behind-the-scenes accounts of High Court cases that have changed Australia. You can catch it on the History Listen podcast on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts. Talk to you next time with more law.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.